in the couple of weeks leading up to it, I remember my brother Mick rang me and everyone was tippy-toeing around me because they knew how much I wanted a baby. But I remember Mick saying, you know, Georgie, Putin's going to invade. And I was like, no. We are speaking to people in Ukraine. They have told us not to be worried about anything. But then, thankfully, we had Annette Hickey in our corner, our solicitor, who was like, whoa, and absolutely put the brakes on everything. Jamie, of course, didn't want to proceed. I'm more look on the bright side of life. I'm like, no, everything will be fine. But it was almost like Jamie had to get my shoulders and shake me.
Hello again and welcome to the Insights podcast. My guest today's life utterly changed in 2017. She had just welcomed her first child and was, as many young parents can relate, awake in the middle of the night when everything stopped as she discovered an unmistakable lump in her breast. Podcaster and breast cancer survivor Georgie Crawford describes that moment as terrifying, lonely, but also lucky. Since then, she has gone on to develop a hugely popular wellness brand. She has welcomed a second baby and, in her own words, learned what it really means to work on yourself. Georgie Crawford, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast. Finding your cancer just 7 months after having your first baby must, as people would imagine, have been terrifying. But you say also that you were lucky to find it. In what way could it have been lucky?
Such a great question, and I'm so delighted to be here. I guess where my lump was in my breast, I came across it quite easily. So my hand fell against it at 1:30 in the morning. It was a lump that I suppose when I found it, I couldn't believe that I hadn't felt it before because it felt so prominent. And I guess as I went through the cancer, I thought, well, what if that had been buried in my breast? Would I have ever found it? Because of my age, because I was 32, I wasn't breast aware. I never checked my breasts before. So in that way, I was lucky because it was right in front of me and there was no denying it.
And might there have been an element of luck as well, Georgie, in the sense that when you found it was as important as where you found it?
Yeah. You know, I knew when I felt it that it was cancer. I was so lucky. I was diagnosed within a week. I was really proactive. I went to the GP at 8 a.m. the next morning. I felt like I was going out and fighting for my life straight away. And everybody around me kept telling me not to worry because that's what we do. I'd heard from friends who had found lumps and they turned out to be nothing. And there was so much positivity around me, but I knew in my heart and soul that I wasn't well. And I guess I had blocked out those feelings for a few months, looking at myself in the mirror, not quite feeling like myself, feeling very tired. So I knew in my heart and soul. And I remember on the Saturday night, I found out on the Tuesday that I had cancer. But on the Saturday night, I just said to my husband, my mum, my sister-in-law, like, please stop telling me that this isn't cancer because I know it is. And in that moment, they supported me in that. And I appreciated that because you're fighting so much that you didn't expect over those couple of days, like all of these intrusive thoughts that you need people to be on the same page as you.
In the usual course of events, you might have felt that lump, looked for an appointment with your GP. That might have taken several days. And then you would have gone on to presumably some sort of waiting list with a consultant.
Yeah, I went to the GP and she said because of my age that I was unlikely to be seen very quickly or considered an urgent case. But she said, look, you can go home, you can ring around the breast clinics. I had private health insurance. So I went home. I didn't collect my baby after the appointment. And I went home, I sat at my kitchen table and I started ringing all of the breast clinics. And I got through to Beaumont Hospital and they said, we have an appointment at 9:20 tomorrow morning. Do you want to come in? I said, yeah. So I went in half hoping that I'd be sent home and told it was all worry over nothing. But it quickly turned into a triple assessment, which is an ultrasound, a mammogram and a biopsy all within 2 hours.
And how quickly after you felt that lump at 1:30 in the morning, how quickly after that did the treatment start?
My cancer was removed within 2 weeks. which was a miracle in itself. I came home from Beaumont Hospital on the 19th of October. Professor Arnie Hill did my surgery. And as I walked through the door, my mum, I remember my house was glowing. It was, you know, a dark winter's night. And I walked through the front door and my mum had candles and my house was spotless. But my mail was on the kitchen table, my post. And I just picked it up and I was looking through it and there was a letter with my name on it. And I opened the letter and it was Vincent's Hospital to tell me that the appointment my GP had made that morning when I ran to her office was in 2 weeks' time. So I could have gone home that day and waited for my appointment, but I really just grabbed the bull by the horns and went out and fought for my life. So my cancer had been removed already.
And the moral of the story for other women?
Be proactive. You know, if you feel like there is something wrong, you have to bang down doors until somebody listens to you. I was so lucky that my GP did listen to me. I know there's so many women who maybe push things away or they say, I don't want to cause any trouble. I'll see if the lump goes away. My cancer had not spread. I'd stage 2 breast cancer. But if I had left it and seen what happened, who knows what might have happened.
Your cancer changed you. You say your cancer changed you utterly. In what way or in what ways?
I'm still trying to figure it out because it's been 7 years. And I used to say it's like I had a brain transplant. So somebody completely changed who I was, everything about me, how I looked at the world, how I listened to people, how I love people. Every part of my life changed. But the more I'm learning about the world and about myself, I think I just appreciate the preciousness of life. And a lot of my friends now are older than me. A lot of the friends that I've made since my cancer diagnosis, I have women in their, well, I'm 40 now, but in their 40s and 50s, who I just absolutely connect with and have the greatest friendships with. But they're women with life experience. And it's almost like I leaped forward 20 years in my life. I still get to be a young person with a young family, but I have the perspective of an older person.
Are there things that used to bother you, used to annoy you, that are just utterly irrelevant now?
All the time. I worked in town in radio at the time. I remember I was the person that was kind of hot and bothered by things a lot, irritated, stressed. I wore stress like a badge of honour. I thought the more stressed I am, maybe I'll get that promotion if everyone around me thinks I'm stressed out of my mind. I mistakenly thought that if I was stressed, maybe people would think I care or I could show them how much I care. But now it's things wash over me a lot easier because I can see that for all of those years before I was 32, it wasn't getting me anywhere. And I think I'm a nicer person to be around, to be honest.
You had a good career going, a successful career in radio before the diagnosis and after you returned from treatment. But why did you pack it in? Why did you leave radio?
I went back to radio. I worked the breakfast show, 98 FM, reading the news. I remember sitting on the N11 at 4:30 one morning on the way into the newsroom.
My jaw is dropping now.
Yeah.
Go on, yeah.
Well, it could have been 10 to 5, but I had to be in for 5. And I remember eating a raw carrot from a bag that I'd prepared the night before. And I had started my health journey and I was really starting to become aware of eating well and sleeping well and stressing less. And I was eating the carrots because I was so concerned that I wasn't sleeping enough anymore that I thought the carrots might keep me alive. I went into my desk and, you know, the news, it can drag you down some days. And I thought, wow, I've been on such a journey. I know the word is definitely overused, but for the last year of my life, and I've learned so much about the world. And here I am doing the same old thing again. And where is this going to lead me to in 5, 10 years? And I remember looking around the newsroom one day and just wanting to hear from women and wanting to hear longer stories and wanting to hear, okay, we get the top line stuff in the news and radio interviews and TV interviews, but we don't really get the learnings or the deep stuff that I all of a sudden became really interested in. So I thought, what if I start a podcast where women come to tell their stories at length? It's time for me to put this new energy and this new appreciation for life into something positive. My podcast would not be what it is without my experience in radio. So I really just built it with there. My husband, Jamie, had a huge background in media and just came in and really just put the wind in my sails. So everything we do in The Good Glow has a meaning and substance behind it. And sometimes that is a lot to take on, you know, and we've said no to so many things because it doesn't align with us. But Jamie, my husband, is so supportive. Like, The Good Glow came from my heart. So he makes it all work. But everything in the heart and soul of it probably comes from me.
What have you said no to?
I've said no to loads of ads, lots of sponsors that don't align. I've been on a fertility journey, so you can imagine I've had a lot of offers to endorse fertility clinics and things. I will only work with brands and people that I absolutely believe in.
There's one that is current, I think, and it's about breast before date.
Yes.
Tell me about that, because it's fairly recently launched.
Thank you for bringing that up, because it is definitely a campaign that I believe will save a life. And that is why I said yes to it. So the idea is, in the SPAR and Eurospars across the country at the moment, there is a breast before sticker on various products. And the idea is, you go into the shop and you scan the QR code, and it simply puts a reminder in your calendar on your phone to check your breasts. When I read this, I was like, that's genius. It's so simple. The reason that I said yes to that is because I said, we're going to hear from a person whose life has been saved because of this campaign.
You mentioned Jamie, your husband, clearly a strong support to you, a key contributor to the whole project of The Good Glow. But he's got his own health story, hasn't he? And it was one that he kept fairly quiet until relatively recently, by which I mean just a few years ago.
Yeah, Jamie was diagnosed with MS in 2012, which was the shock of our lives. I was still in my 20s. He was 32. He had a really busy job. He was head of a group of radio stations and worked a lot, and like me, wore stress like a badge of honour. I mean, we'd go home on a Friday night and talk about work all night. Like, that was what we loved to do. We don't do that anymore. But one side of his face had gone numb when he woke up one day, and later that day he was in his office and he went to open the door of his office and his hand just flopped down. So he went to his GP, and his GP, and he said, well, it's probably one of two things. You either have MS or you've had a stroke. And this man had seen it all over the years. And he was right. Jamie had MS. He was diagnosed within 2 weeks.
But it was a form of MS that isn't necessarily, well, by definition, if he was able to keep it quiet for so long and did, evident to the outside world.
Yeah, it's relapsing remitting. So Jamie will have an episode. His foot could go numb or the side of his face. And then 2 weeks later, he'll go back to normal. So Jamie really took it hard, really was in a bad place for a few years, and really didn't feel like he was the leader of his tribe in work. You know, he was the boss, and he was afraid that if he showed weakness, that people wouldn't come to him with their problems. And he felt like that was his job, to sort out problems. So he didn't want to be seen as weak. Like, there was a very small group of people in the office that knew and supported him, and supported him so much, but it just never got to that point where he felt like he could discuss it.
And how useful was the experience that he'd been through to him and to you in providing the support that you needed yeah. when your turn came?
Let me tell you a funny story. So when I was diagnosed with cancer, myself and Jamie were having a conversation a few months later, and I said, oh, well, you know, what happened to you is so much worse than what's happening to me. And he said, what? No, what's happened to you is so much worse than what's happened to me. And I remember thinking, like, his diagnosis was so much worse than mine. And he was thinking that about me. But I guess the roles just completely flipped. So I had supported him for so many years, and all of a sudden I needed him to support me. And I think he did a better job. He knew exactly what to do.
I'm aware of the fact, Georgie, that your parents broke up when you were very young, when you were about 2 years of age. Now, clearly you and Jamie have a very strong relationship, and that's very solid and going back for many years. But did your own upbringing or your own experience of what happened to your parents, did that make you wary of having that strong relationship with him and being married?
That's such a good question. My parents both moved on to having second marriages and really strong, healthy second marriages. My mum is married to my stepdad, Joe, and they've been together since I can remember. And my dad went on to remarry as well. So I've seen both. I've experienced both. I work harder on my marriage because my parents are separated. But I've also experienced, you know, my mum and Joe, like, not every day is a fairy tale. And I've seen them stick together through thick and thin, you know, 20 odd years later. So I think in my marriage, and we're married 10 years this summer, we've had so many unimaginable things that have happened to us as a young couple. And sometimes I think we work better in a crisis than we do when things are normal.
Now, to go back to where we started this conversation, Georgie, you had just had your first child, and clearly you wanted to have other children, but the cancer intruded on those hopes, plans. So tell me about what happened then.
So we went in, we did a round of IVF when I was sick, just before my chemotherapy started, and it was really successful and we got loads of embryos. But I remember at the time just kind of doing that for everyone else. For Jamie, he really wanted us to do it, and for the doctors who were saying this is a really good idea, I would have done anything a doctor told me to back then.
So did the cancer mean that you couldn't have more children, or was it the treatment, or what was the thinking or the sequencing there?
Yeah. So they didn't know if the chemotherapy would affect my fertility going forward. I kind of felt like I'd be fine. I just had faith that I'd be okay. But for security, they said we're better off trying to get some eggs before chemotherapy starts. Then I was put on a cancer drug called tamoxifen. And if I wanted to have a baby myself, I would have to come off that drug. So that was the second kind of big decision we would have had to make. And COVID had just started. And I remember saying to Jamie, like, I think I'd be really scared to come off my cancer drug now, especially because I had a pregnancy related cancer, because I was diagnosed within a year of having my baby. So I didn't know. I mean, it's a $1 million question. How did I get cancer in the first place? But it was very close to my pregnancy. So I would have felt really scared to be pregnant again, I think, even though the doctors reassured me that I would probably be fine.
So that took you down the surrogacy route.
I didn't know much about surrogacy until I heard Rosanna Davison's story. Just kind of thought this is for people to go to America. I didn't know much about it. But I was getting my hair done one day and Rosanna Davison walked behind my chair. One of the girls said, you know, Rosanna's doing the surrogacy journey. And I said, yeah, it's amazing. And she said, she's doing it in Ukraine. And I said, oh, really? Ukraine? I didn't know anything about it. And then I just started researching and found a solicitor called Annette Hickey, who's an incredible woman. And I needed to learn a lot about it before I made any decisions. But she was telling us, you know, there's a really safe, ethical pathway to having a baby in Ukraine with a surrogate mother. And we decided that this was the right thing for us to do.
And how did you go about pursuing that? I mean, did you go and meet the surrogate mother, or how did all of that unfold? How was it put together?
Yeah, so your surrogate mother, a lot of people think that it's almost like a dating, you're courting this lady. That's not the case, especially in Ukraine and Georgia. So you do not have a relationship with this lady until she is pregnant. Like, you can talk, you can see their profiles, like, you make sure they've legal representation, like, through the agency, that everything is above board. But you're not having a relationship with this lady before she is pregnant, because that could put pressure on her or lead to a lot of disappointment if the embryo doesn't attach or, you know, doesn't go on to become a healthy pregnancy. So in Ukraine, the idea was, we were matched with a lovely lady called Alina, who I've spoken about before. I knew all about her background. She knew everything about us. But at this stage, we weren't texting or on the phone or anything like that.
And what were her own circumstances? How did she come to be engaged or involved in this?
Yeah, so this was her second surrogacy journey, which obviously gave me a lot of reassurance that she enjoyed it the first time. The agency tells you the reason why the person has put themselves forward to become a surrogate mother. And for Alina, it was to buy a house. The surrogate mothers must have had their own child themselves, so they understand exactly what the process will be like.
What about the cost to you?
The cost was, it was my life savings, everything that I had worked for years went into it, and my family helped us as well, and Jamie's family. But really, every penny that we made went into a savings account.
And I mean, that would suggest, I'd surmise you're talking, and I don't want to be too intrusive,
yeah,
but people are obviously interested in these kind of things. I mean, are we well into six figures?
No, we're just touching on. We had a lot of legal costs because we kind of ticked the box on everything. So
yeah,
having an independent legal representative in the country, then our surrogate mother, she would have legal representation, and then we would have legal representation. So we kind of went above and beyond. And then because our embryos were transferred out of Ukraine and into Georgia, and we started the journey again, we lost some money.
Yeah,
because
the war, the invasion, the attack on Ukraine began right at the moment when you were about to begin the process.
I remember, so our embryo transfer was due to take place on Monday, the 21st of February, and the war started that Thursday. In the couple of weeks leading up to it, I remember my brother Mick rang me, and everyone was tippy-toeing around me because they knew how much I wanted a baby. But I remember Mick saying, you know, Georgie, Putin's going to invade. And I was like, no. We are speaking to people in Ukraine. They have told us not to be worried about anything. But then, thankfully, we had Annette Hickey in our corner, our solicitor, who was like, whoa. And absolutely put the brakes on everything. Jamie, of course, didn't want to proceed. I'm more look on the bright side of life. I'm like, no, everything will be fine. Everything will be fine. But it was almost like Jamie had to get my shoulders and shake me and say, Georgie, like, wake up. We cannot do this. I was standing in Dunn's in the cereal aisle on the Thursday before our embryo transfer was due to take place on the Monday. And Jamie had been on the phone to Ukraine, on the phone to Annette, and he rang me and he said, Alina doesn't want to wait. Because we had asked her, you know, can we just wait until things settle? But she had taken all the medication. Her body was ready for an embryo. Nobody in Ukraine believed that this was happening. So she asked to be assigned to another family. And I remember being so angry at Jamie that he told me this news in the cereal aisle of a supermarket. But this is how fast paced the situation was unfolding. And he had to tell me then and there. So I remember running out of the supermarket and sitting in my car and saying, we have to beg her to wait for us. Do anything, beg her, Jamie. And I went in for acupuncture. I had the first appointment. It was 9 a.m. So I couldn't cancel it because I felt bad that they would lose the booking. So I said, I have to go to this appointment. Just sort it out. And I went in and the lady in the appointment knew that I was so upset about something. She didn't know what. And she held my hand and she said, people come here with broken hearts all the time. You're going to be okay. And I walked out an hour later and I rang Jamie and I said, you have to let her go. We have to let her go. I said, we're doing what we think is best for our family, but we have to let her do what's best for her family. And that was the end.
Only it wasn't.
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose it wasn't. It was the end of our journey in Ukraine. So a couple of weeks later, I was sent a picture of a man holding a Ukraine flag beside a car. And in the boot were huge cryotherapy chamber things. I'm in a surrogacy WhatsApp group in Ireland and it said, these are IV meds embryos. And that was our clinic. So as the war that week unfolded and as the bomb started dropping on Kiev, I remember saying to Jamie, like, we can't ask these people where our embryos are. Like, they're in bunkers with their children. So we'd sent an email to say, we hope you're okay, all the people we'd been working with. But I said, we can't ask that question. So I didn't know where my embryos were. I just prayed that they were safe in Kiev and that a bomb hadn't dropped on the clinic. But a couple of weeks later, somebody told me that the embryologist in the clinic on that Thursday put everyone's embryos into the boot of his car and drove them to Slovakia to save them. So Tali, who is our second baby, was now in Slovakia as an embryo. So we moved the entire journey to a different country. So we had to completely leave any hopes and dreams we had of having a baby with Alina in Ukraine behind and literally start again. So the following week, I was looking up surrogacy in Canada. What are the laws there? A surrogacy in America, because Annette was just telling us absolutely no go with Ukraine anymore. Like, it's the end. I was so devastated. I couldn't do anything. But a couple of months later, we found a lot of information about surrogacy in Georgia and that it was very similar to surrogacy in Ukraine. And so we decided to transfer our embryos to Georgia. Now, this is about a year later.
Right. How did it progress from there?
So we were matched with an amazing Georgian lady who had her own family and children. We transferred on my birthday, the 23rd of January, and we got a call 2 weeks later to say she was pregnant.
So instead of heading to, say, Kiev or wherever, you found yourself going to Tbilisi.
A beautiful place. Have you ever been there?
No, nor to Kiev yet.
Yeah. Tbilisi is, there's no direct flights, but it's one of the most beautiful cities I've ever visited. Has a huge foodie culture. It's so modern and cosmopolitan. Everybody is drop dead gorgeous over there. So we first went to Tbilisi when our surrogate mother was 8.5 months pregnant. We arrived into the country and our daughter was born a week later.
And how long then did you stay before you took your daughter home?
We stayed for 3 weeks.
And what about the engagement you had with the person who carried your child for the full 9 months? It can't have been an easy thing for either of you, the parting.
I think for her, she was very relieved when she met us and she met my mum and Joe. She met Pia. She kept, well, our agency told us that she kept saying she was so happy with us. Because I'm sure, as you could imagine, if you carry somebody else's baby for 9 months and they show up and you're not getting a good vibe from these people, it must be very upsetting to hand the baby over. It doesn't feel very natural. I've been lucky enough to give birth to my first baby. So it was completely different situation. But it was so full of love. I was so felt so lucky that she was so happy and taken care of. And it was a lovely process and situation.
This is something which at the time certainly couldn't have been done in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the situation there? I know the law has changed somewhat. Now, there's only provision for non-commercial and altruistic surrogacy. So it can't be a question of money changing hands in this country.
Yes. And also if, say, for example, my sister-in-law said, I'll carry your baby for you, Georgie. You know, she is the baby's mother in that case, even if the baby has my DNA. So in Ireland, whoever actually physically gives birth to the baby is considered the baby's mother. They're on the birth cert. They have legal rights to the baby. So that is why surrogacy is not happening.
That's as a result, is it of a Supreme Court judgment, or how does that, what's the legal basis for that?
It is like a law as old as time. And so this law apparently had been changed over in the UK, I think in the 80s. And that's why Irish Families Through Surrogacy, Annette Hickey and Rosanna Davison, Mark from Westlife, have all been campaigning for so many years to try and change this. So I was in Tbilisi, Georgia. My name was on Tally's birth cert. But as soon as I touched down in Dublin Airport, as soon as we landed in Ireland, I became a legal stranger to my child, despite her having my DNA, despite, you know, us creating the embryos back in 2017. So technically that means Jamie then had to apply for full custody of Tally, which he has now. And as the law stands, Jamie would have to give his approval or sign a document in 2 years for me to become Tally's guardian. So when I heard that the man has to sign or give permission, I remember thinking, wow, I'm so lucky that I'm in a safe and happy marriage and my husband will sign that piece of paper. But people's circumstances change and it just felt a little bit unsafe. And that's why I got involved in the campaign. And luckily, Stephen Donnelly worked with Irish Families Through Surrogacy and they managed to get it through.
What is the situation now then?
So it hasn't been enacted. Mm. Nothing has changed.
Right. But it's the law. The law is there. It's just that it hasn't commenced. Is that,
yes,
is that the way that works? It needs a ministerial order.
Yes, I think so. Annette was talking about it on her Instagram page the other day. And I remember her saying, like, it's all well and good that we've gotten to this point, but we need to keep going.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, Georgie, that you'd had loads of embryos. So what are your plans for the other ones?
Oh, I don't have plans for the other ones. We have embryos in Georgia and we have some in the Beacon in Dublin. But I think unless I win the lotto, I think we're done.
Mm. Do you think it might be possible perhaps for other women who want to have babies and can't for whatever reasons? I mean, would you be willing to give them or to help them along that?
Oh, I've thought about that so many times, but I just don't know if I could donate my embryos because I'm so in love with my two children. I don't think I could know that I had a third out there that I couldn't kiss and hug every single minute of the day.
It's a tough one, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How long can they be maintained then in a place like the Beacon or in Georgia?
I think it's 10 years.
Right.
So I don't think they will transfer an embryo that is older than 10 years. So we froze in 2017. So we've got 2 years.
Okay, well, look, it's obviously a very personal thing for you and for Jamie to think about and to consider. Coming back, though, to, you know, how your life was transformed by the discovery of that lump. I mean, is it true to say that you weren't particularly bothered about taking exercise before all that?
Never. I was, I suppose, what would you call me? A skinny girl. I could eat whatever I wanted. I had such a fast-paced lifestyle. I just lived to be working, going out at the weekends, footloose and fancy free. But then this lump came along and reminded me of how precious life is and how easily it can be taken away from you. I remember you've had Jerry Hussey on this podcast. I've listened to it. It's such a great episode. And I could listen to Jerry. I have a podcast with Jerry myself. I could listen to Jerry over and over again. Say, and I could listen to him say the same thing over and over again and take something different from it each time. He has such a deep understanding of the world. So I started to listen to people like him and grow and learn and be open to new journeys. I remember, you know, when I worked in radio, I thought I knew it all. You know, I really did. And when I was sitting in my chemotherapy chair, the top floor of the Beacon, I realised I knew nothing at all. Nothing. And
is that the illness, or is it maybe a bit more maturity or combination?
I've often thought, have most of my learnings come from having a baby or from having cancer? Because they happened at the same time. But I think what cancer gave me, and I wonder if anyone listening will be able to resonate with this. Cancer gave me time. All of a sudden, I had time, which I had never had before, a thought that I never had before. So I'd go in on a Monday for my chemotherapy and have nothing but a 7-hour stretch ahead of me. And I'd sit down, I thought, what am I going to do here, sitting here all day? But I said, I'm going to start learning about the world and about myself. And I'm going to sit in silence for the first time in my life and actually just reflect. And when I started to reflect, I started to realize that, oh my God, how did I expect to live a long and healthy life with the things that I was doing and the ways that I was living? I have this story in my book called The Burnt Potato. And women really resonate with it because it's basically a metaphor for when you put the dinner in the oven and say you take out your beautiful lasagna, but the corner of it is burnt. And so often we will put the burnt food on our own plate and give everybody else the lovely part of the dish because we want everyone else in our life to have a great experience and for everything to be great for them. But you're willing to sacrifice yourself and eat the burnt food. And I ate the burnt food for 10 plus years. I ate the burnt food when Jamie was diagnosed with MS. I ate the burnt food in work every day. So as I was sitting in my garden with my dressing gown on at 2 o'clock in the afternoon with not a blade of hair on my body as a young woman, I thought, how did I expect to live when all I did was eat the burnt potato? I lived so differently now.
And you started not just take exercise, but to get into serious running.
A serious runner. Yeah. Who's never increased their pace. I'm a slow runner. I love to enjoy the journey, or that's what I tell myself. I started running. I started doing the park run, which just was like, I remember doing the park run and thinking I was going down to the park to exercise. But when I opened my eyes and looked around, like there was people like patting you on the back and smiling at you and dogs and babies. And I'd just come back from the park run feeling like I'd climbed Mount Everest. I couldn't believe, I used to do the park run in my wig. I was like, wow, it's so much more than just exercise. It's a completely different way of life. So now fast forward all of these years later, we're about to bring 190 runners to the New York Half Marathon on Team Good Glow. I'm a Breast Cancer Ireland ambassador. Mm-hmm. So I have a dream to create, I'll tell you now, a 5-kilometer run, but a virtual one, because I have listeners in Australia, America, you know, all over the world, and get everyone out doing a 5K on the same day and do a big fundraiser for Breast Cancer Ireland. So hopefully that's coming this year.
The people who listen to your podcast and the people who relate to you, are they mostly women, or what's in it for men?
Yeah. Oh, I love that question. Do you know what I hear from men, actually? I always hear from men, I feel like I know you because I hear your voice all around my house or in my bed on a Sunday night. Because my podcast is released on Sundays. I get on really well with men.
But your followers on social media, are they mainly women?
Yes, 98%.
Well, after this conversation, maybe you might just have one more follower. Anyone who follows you knows how important wellness is. But are you ever concerned about the toll that social media takes on maybe you, but lots of other people, physically and mentally?
Yeah, I have taken a bit of a step back from social media. And I kind of thought that was part of my maternity leave for Tali, but I'm finding it hard to get back out there. And I will, but I need to figure out what my purpose is now. You know, it's kind of hard. I've never been one for saying something for the sake of it. I think social media has just become so loud and noisy. And I think sometimes we're almost moving in a different direction.
But it's also addictive. It takes so much time as well. I mean, do you have times or periods in your day or in your week where you just leave all that stuff aside?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I quit every single day. You know, I down tools. I prioritize rest, peace, silence. I think through creating the Good Glow community and our run clubs, I actually prefer sitting down beside someone and having a chat rather than back and forth on the phone. I have a lot of women that I run with now, like shoulder to shoulder, and we'll just talk. And for me, that is so much more powerful. It's like, I will say, cancer ended up giving me more than it took from me. Like, it took so much from me. It took my innocence. It took my hair for a time. It took the ability to be pregnant again, to look at the world with a certain amount of innocence, as I said. But what it gave me is so much more. It gave me so many amazing, incredible friendships.
And what about social media and your children, 1 8, the other just one? First of all, about their use of it and their access to it, to social media. But also, are you in any way concerned about maybe, you know, allowing your own children to feature in your content online?
Yeah, I wouldn't put them up a lot. I keep them very, very private. So we've also signed something in the school, a contract to say that we won't give our daughter, Pia, a phone for the duration of primary school. And I love this initiative because so many parents have signed it. And then when your child, the idea is when your child comes to you and says, can I have a phone? You can say, well, 90% of your class don't have one.
And does that apply, by the way, to non-school hours, weekends, holidays?
I will do everything and anything I can not to have a phone in Pia's hand, ideally till she's 16. But the thoughts of the phones absolutely terrifies me. The thought of people looking in at my family with not good intention also terrifies me. So I do keep them very private.
And what about things like, I know you don't need to do this on the phone, but Peppa Pig and Miss Rachel and all that kind of stuff that can be quite educational, not to mention pacifying.
Yeah. Oh, listen, like at 6:30 in the morning, my child, Tali, is watching nursery rhymes, like sitting beside me in the bed. We're not perfect. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, when I was sick, when I was going through chemo, Pia watched a lot of TV because I physically couldn't entertain her. I'd lie on the couch and feel half dead because I probably in some ways was. And she watched a lot of Peppa Pig, and now she is a vibrant, amazing, exciting, interesting little girl.
Does it worry you, or are you concerned that maybe the cancer might come back?
Yeah, I do worry that the cancer will come back. I try to live in the day, in the moment and in the day as much as possible. All I can control is what I can do today to keep myself healthy and well. And that comes with a little bit of pressure, of course, and a little bit of guilt, which I have learned to manage. And I think COVID brought a lot of balance to my life because I was really going hell for leather on the exercise and the health and all of that. And then COVID happened and we had nothing to do but make a lovely creamy pasta and have a glass of wine. And I allowed myself to do that because actually it's about balance. And I've embraced balance and I don't give out to myself as half as much as I used to. And that's probably because I'm a little bit further away from the cancer. But you know, I check myself, I keep up with all my appointments, I eat well, I try to be a good person, and I get out for a few runs and I pray every night.
Really?
Yeah.
To whom or to what?
To just a higher power. just to keep us well. And I really believe in my journey and my path. And I think I've made peace with that. I think when I first was diagnosed, I was so terrified of dying and leaving everyone behind. But I think I've done a lot over the last 7 years. I have a full life that obviously I'd be absolutely devastated beyond words to leave this earth early. But I've dropped my shoulders a little bit, and I think I've done a pretty good job.
And in praying to the higher power, I mean, are you part of a particular faith, for instance?
I'm a Catholic. Jamie's a Protestant, and we would go to the local Church of Ireland. My kids are Church of Ireland as well. And there is a man, Fred Appleby, who I found my lump 3 days after Pia's christening, and we'd gotten her christened in Rathmichael Church. And Fred Appleby was the reverend there. And the next week we went back, and he put up his, we were late, of course, but he is in the middle of a song, and he put up his arms and he was like, "Welcome back." And I just said, "I found a lump." And he took my hand in that moment and he prayed for me. And he visited me every week of chemotherapy. And he also knew that I was in chemotherapy on Mondays, and that my mum would be in my house minding Pia, and then he'd go and visit her too.
What a wonderfully Christian man.
Amazing person who's such a big part of our journey, and who reminded me that God is there, and there is somebody looking out for me.
Do you believe in an afterlife?
I believe in a lot of signs. We lost Jamie's dad shortly after our wedding. We get lots of signs from him. I think in a way I have to believe. That's what keeps me, you know, not having an anxiety attack when I think about dying. But I would like to think that a part of you lives on, and we certainly will live on through our children. Kindness and raising good little girls. And I don't mean good girls. I mean people who care about other people, who are also not afraid to stick up for themselves from time to time, but who are loving people. And that's the legacy that I hope I'll leave.
Georgie Crawford, what a wonderful note on which to end. Thank you so much indeed for your time for your insights.
Thank you.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll find a whole range of episodes with our wonderful guests who share their insights, including former Laskeon Corla Deputy Catherine Connolly, garden designer and presenter Diarmaid Gavin, manager of the Saw Doctors and founder of the Galway Arts Festival, Ollie Jennings, plus many, many more. And remember, if you hit the follow button on your preferred platform, you'll be alerted when a new episode becomes available.